like the UK.
Now, joining us on the show this week to discuss this extremely important topic are two very special guests. We are honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted, where justice is denied and human rights are suppressed. Stephen is also chair of the Covivencia Alliance and the director of the Institute for the Study of Christian Zionism, as well as being a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Essel. We are also pleased to welcome a favourite of the show back, Sayyid Ammar Kazmi, who helps run the Left Legal Fighting Fund, a legal defence fund which focuses on assisting anti-racist, anti-fascist and anti-Zionist individuals and groups who need legal support. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you both. Reverend Sizer, if I could start here with yourself, how would you define interfaith and what are the benefits of such dialogue and events?
Interfaith is about people of different faiths coming together to understand one another's background. It's not about proselytism. It's about complementing, collaborating on issues of common concern, whether it's poverty or racism, extremism, or in a case at the moment, Gaza. It's about listening rather than speaking. It's about empathizing, putting ourselves in the shoes of the other and finding what we have in common common cause and then working together to ameliorate, whether it's natural disasters, human suffering or extremism.
So then what would you say the Zionist movement seeks to achieve by engaging in interfaith, in what some have described as soft war strategy? Why are they spending time, effort and money perhaps speaking to people who may oppose their ideology?
Well, we've just been describing what I would call authentic interfaith dialogue, where we treat one another as equals, respectful and seeking to understand one another. The kind of interfaith dialogue that the Zionist movement engages in is very different. It's along the lines of, we set the agenda and therefore you cannot criticize Israel. So it becomes a tool to suppress human rights, suppress challenging Israel's actions. So for example, in the UK we have the Council of Christians and Jews, CCJ. But in reality it's the Council of Christians for Jews. It never criticizes the Jewish community, never criticizes Israel. It's used as a means of suppressing Christian critiques of what Israel does.
And Ammar, if I could turn to yourself as well and maybe first ask you the same question, that what does the Zionist movement seek to achieve by engaging in such interfaith? And also maybe touching on any personal experiences or professional experiences you've had when dealing with these types of events.
Well, as Reverend Sizer was quite eloquently explaining, you know, there's nothing wrong in principle with having interfaith dialogue. In fact, you know, particularly between the three Abrahamic faiths, I think there's been lots of interfaith dialogue and discussion over many centuries. This is not really something new. The issue is really in terms of how the Zionist movement and the state of Israel in particular seeks to weaponize this term interfaith and this idea of interfaith dialogue in order to serve its own interests, which really is has manifested itself in terms of infiltrating, you know, Muslim communities, trying to essentially get them on board with the idea of being friends with welcoming Zionists who are openly Zionists into their communities, into their mosques, breaking bread with them. And that has a kind of insidious effect because, you know, if you're talking with somebody and you're becoming friends with them and you're becoming friendly with them under the guise of interfaith, but really this person is trying to promote Zionism, it could help to compromise that individual, that Muslim or that Christian who's speaking to them in a very sort of soft way, because the next time that person sees atrocities happening in Gaza, in Palestine, or, you know, wants to criticize Israel in any way, perhaps they might think twice. They think, well, you know, I met this person and they seem to be pro-Israel. Maybe I don't want to offend them. I don't want to disturb these interfaith community relations we've developed. So this is actually one of the strategies. It's not necessarily just about open proselytism and saying, you know, you should defend Israel because of this, that, and the other. It's also about trying to compromise people through their relationships. And this is sort of the most insidious factor that the Zionist movement and the Zionist interfaith industry, you know, has.
And it's almost like trying to disarm people, if you will, by default, really, as you mentioned there. Just staying with yourself, Ammar, what's the danger in the holy month of Ramadan in particular? Of course, at the moment, billions of Muslims around the world are observing Shahr Ramadan. What kind of events do you see the Zionists seeking to exploit? If you could expand on perhaps some of these types of strategies.
Well, there are a plethora of these interfaith organizations within Britain. And so during this holy month of Ramadan, of course, you know, I was just talking about breaking bread. This is the perfect opportunity to try to organize things like interfaith iftars, organize, you know, invite different sections of the Muslim community who may be completely unaware. And this is the problem. There's a complete lack of curiosity, lack of skepticism, and indeed a naivety when it comes to this. And so, you know, you have Muslims and mosques being invited to these interfaith iftars and, you know, in a spirit of, you know, brotherly or community generosity. And so it's essentially a time in which the interfaith faith-washing industry is able to turbocharge its agenda within the Muslim community, because at this point in time, you know, Muslims are quite vulnerable in the sense that, you know, many Muslims begin becoming much more active in terms of their religious practice, in terms of their attendance at events, their attendance at mosques throughout the country during the holy month of Ramadan. And it's an opportune moment to take advantage of that, basically.
Thank you, Sayyid Ammar. Dr. Sizer, now, obviously, you are an esteemed member of the Christian community and a reverend, of course, as well. Have you ever been maybe invited to or attended or, you know, been part of an event, and maybe it's become clear to you later on, hang on a minute, this may be, you know, engaging with Zionists or something? Has that been something that people have tried to reach out and maybe pressure you to engage in?
Do you mean in terms of from a Zionist perspective?
Or? Yeah, like just in terms of, you know, maybe some groups reaching out and saying, we want to do some interfaith, maybe before, you know, your views on Zionism were perhaps as well-known as they were.
To be honest, no. I think most of the times I've engaged with Zionists, it's been in a situation where they've tried to challenge me or debate with me. So I've made several programs with Zionist TV stations, radio stations, where they've tried to trap me, tried to engage with me. But I think they gave up trying to win me from the very beginning. I think I've been involved in lots of interfaith events and opportunities, particularly with Jewish and Muslim friends, where we're genuinely trying to find areas of common ground that we can work together.
Yeah. And I think that's key. It's, you know, sincerity and genuinely engaging with people who aren't trying to use interfaith, which some actually prominent Zionists in the UK, for example, have openly said. We use interfaith as a way to make the case for Israel in a church or in a mosque, and describe the kind of disarming tactics that Ammar was alluding to as well. Now, of course, Ayin Islam did speak to people in London to ask them their thoughts on the attempts being made across the world to normalise the existence of the Zionist entity in the name of interfaith.
I think that interfaith is a good thing. It's good to kind of get to know other faiths and what they're doing, and it builds those connections to start conversations. I think that we have to differentiate between kind of interfaith events and opportunities to network and connect, and almost creating that network to buffer down and silence a lot of our own opinions and a lot of our own viewpoints, with this idea that because we're kind of connected and friendly, it gives us kind of puts us in a bit more awkward situation, position to kind of speak up about what we believe in. So I think that it's a good thing, but within our boundaries and with our kind of understanding of what we can talk about and what we can't.
Any multi-faith projects in that context would have been used as a kind of form of submission, in the same way you might see it in geopolitics, where Certain countries may say we're looking for forgiveness, peace, friendliness, etc., but ultimately it might be lending itself more towards submission or to acceptance of oppression. I think we shouldn't assume that they're normalization projects, for example. We should look at each case critically. And there are a lot of things that we don't want to politicize as Muslims, but ultimately, if our enemies, we know them, they are politicizing it, we should look out for those cases and be ready to treat those cases accordingly.
They're the sort of events where our point of view can generally be put across, where we're building up allies so that they can defend us in our times of need. And those are then those are, of course, positive events and positive things that we should do. But if there are events where it's just tokenism and it's just a whole bunch of chaps patting each other's backs and nothing actually being achieved in the long term, then I don't see what the point is.
Now, Reverend, if I could come back to yourself. We know that initially Zionism was an anti-Semitic, kind of evangelical Christian project, if you will, before it was a so-called Jewish one. Can you elaborate more on that?
Yes. At the end of the 18th century, Napoleon was at war with the British. French and the British were competing to control North Africa, the Middle East, and our trade routes to our colonies and other parts of the world. And Napoleon was the first world ruler in 2,000 years to promise the Jews a homeland in Palestine because he wanted the wealthy Jewish bankers to back his war effort against the British. So he set the price on Palestine. He was unable to deliver, but by the 1820s, British politicians were recognizing the need to secure the support of the Jewish community to help defeat the French and then eventually the Germans to control Palestine, because Palestine is the bridge, if you like, between the continents. So the race was on to control Palestine. So it was driven by some who were philo-Semitic, who genuinely loved the Jewish people and felt they should be returned to the land of their origins in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. But the anti-Semitic element was either implicit or explicit. Implicit in the sense that they were a tool of British colonialism. Mm-hmm. You know, the Balfour Declaration promised the Jews a homeland in the British Empire. It didn't promise them a state, didn't promise them independence. We weren't giving land away in the beginning mm-hmm. of the 20th century. The explicit anti-Semites just wanted to get rid of the Jews mm-hmm. out of Europe, out of Britain, and plant them in the Middle East. So the Zionist project, the Christian involvement, preceded Jewish Zionism by at least 50 years, more than that. And today, 9 out of 10 Zionists are Christians. Yeah. John Hagee, for example, one of the leaders of the Christian Zionist movement in the States, said, imagine 50 million evangelical Christians in America joining in common cause with 5 million Jewish people in America. It's a match made in heaven. Mm. He's put that 10 to 1. So you've got that heavy emphasis of what is now American foreign policy rather than British foreign policy mm-hmm. to maintain a presence in the Middle East through the Israeli state.
And what's interesting is, you know, actually, perhaps both sides aren't very complimentary of each other, because from what I understand, those evangelical elements believe that, you know, the Jews must be forcibly converted at the end of times, and you know, the Talmud has less than complimentary words about Jesus and Christians, for example. But there seems to be this marriage of convenience at the moment between these two sides. And also, it's interesting you mentioned the British state, because, of course, they promised the homeland. But then there was this campaign of terrorism by groups like the Haganah and the Stern Gang and the Irgun, who attacked British politicians and statesmen and the King David Hotel on that road to getting their independence from Britain. So just interesting that whilst we see this philo-Semitism, actually under the surface, there's been a lot of violence, particularly from the Zionist movement. Sayed Ammar, if I could come back to you. And we saw earlier, of course, Muslims in London. They are clearly aware of the disguise, if you will, being used by these normalisation projects. But what role do collaborators in the Muslim and Christian community, for that matter, play in terms of how they enable this agenda?
Well, the role of collaborators is absolutely vital, not just in faith washing, but also more broadly in terms of furthering the interests of nefarious actors, be it, you know, Islamophobes within the British state, or elsewhere, without those sort of collaborators, the sort of good face, if you like, of this activity, there wouldn't be the depth of infiltration within our mosques and our churches. And that's principally because the people who are allowing them into these spaces are the people very often who are leaders in our community, people who are trustees of different buildings and centers. And so it's them who are principally responsible for allowing these Zionist actors into our spaces, and also promoting it within, you know, the Muslim community as something harmless. And actually, I have to say, I think that it's largely a case of naivety than it is of malice, because I think when Muslims and Christians, who by and large are very, you know, peace-loving people, who love their, you know, brothers in faith in terms of the Abrahamic faiths, when they see this issue of interfaith, they think, well, of course, we, you know, have lots of common ground. We are monotheistic. We have, you know, we believe in many of the same scriptures and prophets. So why wouldn't we try to have a dialogue to engage and get to know each other better and work on various issues that are of mutual interest? So, for example, when it comes to Muslims and Jews in particular, issues around burial rights are very important. It's important for Jews and Muslims in local areas to, you know, have a dialogue when it comes to their councils in terms of arranging those issues to do with funerals, for example. They see this and think, well, why wouldn't we be involved? But there is a lack of curiosity and, as I say, a naivety about some of the broader aims being pushed. And of course, there are those people who we shouldn't give the benefit of doubt to, who, you know, have been very active in this interfaith peace washing and faith washing industry for a long time, you know exactly what they're doing. So those actors are completely critical in terms of giving the Zionist movement the depth that they have within our Muslim and Christian communities across the world, but, you know, particularly in Britain and the United States.
And Amar, if I could just stay with you as well. Due to the environment of hate and pressure that we're seeing placed on the Muslim community, they're guilt-tripped sometimes into participating in normalisation projects, maybe to prove their innocence and to prove they aren't anti-Semitic. How do you advise Muslims, and indeed, again, Christians, to proceed when faced with these types of infiltration attempts and these pressure attempts in our communities?
Well, I think I can only really speak on in terms of Muslims, because I think we have there are some particular issues with our community, which is that by and large, the Muslim community is made up of immigrants and descendants of immigrants in Britain. Of course, there are many people who converted to Islam, but principally, you know, say comes from a population that doesn't originate, you know, from Britain, as it were, at least in sort of the last sort of 60, 70 years. And so there are multiple issues at play. For some people, there is an issue of thinking of being sort of grateful guests, if you like. I like this term, grateful guest syndrome. They think that they don't really have any power or agency in Britain, and so they are at the behest of the British state and all of these various interests. And if they don't accommodate them in some way, then, you know, they could end up being deported. They could have issues in terms of their, you know, immigration status. They could be put on lists. They could be targeted in some way. So that's an issue that I think is particular to the Muslim community more than it is to the Christian community. But also, I think it's a lack of confidence in one's own convictions, because if you are catching wind to the idea that basically this is being used to sort of leverage Zionist interests within the Muslim community, and you don't do anything about that because you're scared of potentially the charity commissioner is going to come after you, maybe you're not going to get funding from, you know, the Home Office or something like that, and so you end up compromising on your religious ideals to promote that, then that's really a question of a lack of religious conviction, and indeed of, in some ways, you know, it might be considered by some to be a strong language, but I think it's absolutely appropriate. It's kind of a treachery to your own values, never mind to your fellow you know, community members.
Yeah, absolutely. And Reverend, if I could ask you the same type of question. What advice would you have to people who are faced with, I mean, you've come under immense pressure and kind of campaigns by Zionist organisations. What advice would you have to others in terms of standing strong, if you will?
Find out more. Reach out. If you're breaking your Ramadan fast, invite neighbors, Christians, Jews, to join you. Find out who they are, what you have in common as parents, as grandparents, as in your communities. Reach out and find out more about anti-Zionist Jewish organizations, for example, the Jewish Network for Palestine or the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, to Jewish organizations I'm involved with. The Convivencia Alliance brings together three faith communities to work for justice and peace in Palestine, or from the Palestinian Christian perspective, organizations like Sabil or Kairos, because people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm. And we have so much in common that is far more than the things on which we differ. We are stronger together, and that's why I would encourage those listening our program to engage in interfaith dialogue. You have nothing to lose, so much to gain.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your wonderful insights, Reverend. And of course, as well to you, Brother Sayed Amar Kazmi. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. And I'd like to also thank you at home. You can join us again next week for another edition. Assalamu alaikum.
Shaima al-Sawaf is one of hundreds of families across Gaza partly or entirely wiped out by the Zionist regime bombardment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East I wrote, the life of Shaima al-Sawaf was turned upside down in an instant. The 30-year-old, who has lived in Jordan since her marriage in 2013, lost 50 members of her family after an Israeli regime missile weighing hundreds of kilograms struck their home in Gaza. The al-Sawaf family is one of hundreds of families in the Gaza Strip that have been partially or wholly wiped out by the Zionist regime's bombardment of the enclave since October 7th. Last summer, Shaima visited her family in Gaza. She spent weeks with them as if she was saying goodbye without knowing it. Among those killed were her father, Mustafa, her mother, Maha, her brothers, Mahmoud, Muntasir, Marwan, and Ahmad, her nieces and nephews, Bara, Maha, Karam, Shahad, and Omar, her sister-in-law, Zain. Omar was the youngest at only 18 months old, while a number of her uncles, cousins, and their wives also lost their lives. The bad news arrived quickly. Hours after the bombing, Shaima was able to call her cousin, who continued to cry bitterly down the phone. Shaima's husband took the phone and spoke to him, then fell silent, ended the call, and tears began to flow down his cheeks. I went crazy. I lost my nerve. I started screaming. Tell me who among them died, recalled Shaima. She said, he said desperately, all of them. I had a nervous breakdown and didn't feel anything around me after that. More than 31,000 Palestinians have been martyred in the ongoing Zionist regime's assault, while more than 71,000 have been injured, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. 40 days before the start of the Zionist regime's assault, Shaima left for her home in Amman. When she met her husband, a refugee from Jaffa, and left Gaza, she felt that she had left a piece of her heart behind. But she remained in daily contact with her family for hours, following their news and sharing their events from a distance. She said, "The war began with a constant anxiety inside me. I could barely sleep and I watched the news and the sights of the Israeli bombing, which didn't differentiate between man, woman, child, elderly, sick and wounded. If I hadn't left, if I had stayed and died with them." With the beginning of the Israeli regime airstrikes, Shaima's long calls to her family turned into short words just to make sure they were okay. The family left their home in the Sheikh Ajlin neighborhood when the bombing intensified and moved to a residential building in At-Tofa area where Shaima's uncles live and where her father also had an apartment. At dawn on November 18th, Shaima read the news that a residential building had been targeted in the same area. She was terrified and started crying while trying to contact her family, but no one answered. She said, "My anxiety and fear increased. My husband tried to calm me down, but I felt a disaster was approaching. Communications were cut off from Gaza and I knew nothing. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I did nothing but pray and cry." Due to the lack of facilities and the imposed siege, the civil defense crews were unable to work effectively at the site of the bombing. The whole family was struck under the rubble and were extracted dead, except for Zaid, aged 8, the son of Mahmoud, who was killed with his wife and the rest of their children. Shaima describes what happened as an unforgettable tragedy. Little by little, the news began to reach Shaima. The next day, she received word of the survival of her brothers, Montasser, Marwan, Mu'taz, and Muhammad, who were injured. Montasser, her journalist brother, who lost one of his eyes in the bombing, called and began to console her and reassure her about him and the rest of her siblings who had survived. She said, "I continue to cling to the hope that a number of my siblings had survived, despite my intense pain over the loss of my parents and my nephews. I spoke every day with Marwan and Montasser, and I didn't know that these were farewell calls to them as well." On December 1st, an Israeli regime plane bombed the Al-Daraj neighborhood in Gaza City, killing Montasser, Marwan, and a number of other relatives. Montasser remained bleeding for about half an hour without any ambulances being able to reach him. Rayyan 10, one of Shaima's three children, sits in his room in Amman and cries hard. Shaima said he loved his cousins very much and talked to them constantly. He had a special relationship with my father. I'm still in pain like the first day of the massacre. I talk to their pictures and imagine them next to me. The most painful thing for Shaima is that she couldn't look at them one last time before burying them because of the war and siege. She said, "Gaza is everything I love, and it has the smell of my family and their memories," adding she hoped to return one day. Shaima is left with only her two brothers, Mu'taz, and the injured Muhammad, who needs to travel for treatment but still can't. She talks to them daily and they try to heal their wounds together by remembering the family members amid constant fear due to the continued Israeli regime aggression. Before the war began, due to a glitch in her phone, Shaima lost her photos of her family and was unable to recover them. She said, "I got very angry and cried more. I want to look at them again, but I don't have all the pictures. Our first house was completely bombed and turned into rubble, and all my brother's phones were crushed by that. Today, Shaimo lives a severely diminished life. Despite everything that has happened, she says that she's still waiting for one of them to contact her, even if the wait is forever.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we talk to one of Ireland's finest comedians, a man that has recently taken Twitter by storm, now also an author. His recent book details the horrific consequences of addiction and the redemptive process of recovery. Never shying away from politics, he's been a strong advocate for Irish unification and Palestinian self-determination. Tadhg Hickey, welcome to the show.
Thanks a million, Sean. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. So tell me, Tadhg, I've recently read your book and I was bemused by some of it, so the honesty in the reading in the book. And actually, it was an amazing book, and it's great to see it's someone just put it out there like you did. Particularly, you're a comedian, you know, and you're not very, very funny, but also very, very profound. I really enjoyed
Jesus,
it.
Jesus, thanks a million, man. Thank you.
And the stuff, I mean, your childhood growing up, do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, like, I'd say it was a happy childhood, you know, so, and this is the funny thing about drinking, because alcoholism is a mental illness, and that's kind of the premise of the book, I suppose. I feel like in Ireland, people think of drinking and drinkers and alcoholics as a kind of an aberration, you know, that they've done something wrong morally. But the fact is that they're sick, and I was sick. But I wasn't always sick. And I suppose that's the point of the childhood. There was moments where I felt, you know, and when I say sick, I mean you need something to treat the illness. And the illness really is kind of, for me anyway, anxiety. Uncomfortableness, I think, is I might have called it. But I wouldn't have put the term anxiety on it. But that anxiety would have come and it would have gone. You know, it wasn't something that was there all the time. It would kind of spike, and it would spike in bizarre settings. Like, I remember being a kid and playing soccer with my buddies and just this kind of sense of gloom coming over myself and feeling uncomfortable in myself. And, like, it was kind of working class 80s Cork. Like, I wasn't about to go home and, you know, call a family meeting about it. We didn't talk about those kind of things. And as I say, when I was struck with a bit of anxiety, I probably thought I was mad. There was a big fear, whether it was just me or it was my community, you didn't want to be mad. You know, mad people were taken away by men in white coats and they were brought to hospital. Sometimes if your drinking got totally out of hand, you'd kind of wander in over the line into madness, like, and so-and-so, he's gone away to some place and he's kind of locked up. That's what you didn't want. And that would have been a fear of mine from a very early age, because this anxiety, I wouldn't have called it that at the time. The feeling comes up, you're kind of going, am I mad? But then it would go away again, and I'd enjoy doing the things I did, like playing football and hanging out with my mates and stuff. And as I say, I was a happy kid. I was obsessed with my dad. I used to kind of follow my dad around. He was a good bit older. I was a real afterthought in the family. I was quite young. But as I detail in the book, he was an ordinary man, but he was extraordinary to me. Like, he just seemed like he had life all figured out. Whereas I felt like I was kind of caught up in myself. I was worried how I was coming across. Did people like me? How do I get people to like me? He just seemed to be breezing through life, not worrying about any of these things. You know, he just seemed to have it figured out.
And you also noted in the book that your saviour was through acting and writing. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so the uncomfortableness that I had, to go back to that again, that could, you could get rid of that loads of different ways. When I was younger playing sport, I played soccer, reasonable level in Cork. I wasn't a bad soccer player, and that would often take it away. But getting involved in performing or acting a bit, normally the type of acting I tried to do involved comedy, and I suppose that was the origins of the comedy thing. Putting on voices, making funny noises, taking the piss out of people in my family, and doing impressions of them, all that kind of stuff. And when I was performing, and mostly in school and with friends and stuff, people would laugh, and that was another addiction straight away. Like, but it definitely got rid of that feeling of uncomfortableness, and it gave me a sense of that this is kind of the thing that I'm supposed to be at. And when I was doing the thing that I was supposed to be doing, I felt, and that I felt like I was enjoying it, again, just that feeling of, like, there's something up with me, I feel uncomfortable and I can't put my finger on it, just started to dissipate.
So what was the spark, man, that led to a career in comedy?
I think one of the first moments that I thought to myself, I would like to do comedy, was actually when I was a kid, and my sister and myself were very close, and she had a real influential role on my taste in everything. And she also had a really refined kind of sense of humour, and kind of, you know, Rick Mail and The Young Ones and all that type of kind of anarchic British comedy, which I loved. So I used to try and make her laugh, and I thought if she laughed at something that I had said, that was a good bar, you know, that I'd made my sister laugh because she was funny. And then it became a kind of a thing of, like, oh, how much can I get her to laugh? And, like, oh, she didn't like this thing. And it's like my first audience, I suppose. I was also trying to make my mother laugh and whatnot. And then I remember going to, so by secondary school, I think, you know, the feeling of starting secondary school is, I was a fat kid as well, right? I hope I can say fat. I know it's probably not the nice thing to say these days, but I am saying it about myself. And I got to school, you're fat, my hair was kind of weird, and you're just self-conscious. Like, you're kind of going, how am I going to fit in here? My brothers, as I say, were tougher men, and they probably would have went straight into the kind of, like, I'll kick your head in type of thing. And I knew I didn't really have that in me, but I knew I had a sharp tongue, and I knew it could make people laugh, and I also knew I could make people a bit scared, because if they mocked you and you mocked them back and you made other people laugh more, I was aware that that was a real strong currency. So I just fell into kind of making people laugh, and no one really bullied me, and I kind of went to the top of the kind of social structure in school because I was able to look after myself with my tongue as opposed to my fists, you know. So that was the first inkling that I was kind of, that I was good at it. But then you go on this whole journey of, you know, am I going to be so cocky as to demand that people sit in a room and listen to me because I'm so funny? Like, that for me, that's an incredibly, it's an audacious expression of self-confidence and self-belief. What I initially did, I did music, and I love music as well. I mean, that was a huge, huge passion of mine. I was in a band, and I would try and make some of the lyrics funny, and I was kind of playing the role of a comedian within a band. So I was hiding in a band as a comedian, I think. We were called Exit Pursued by a Bear.
What did you call it?
Exit Pursued by a Bear. So it's a pretentious quote from Winter's Tale, and the whole band was very pretentious, and I was the main reason for that. But that was my way of kind of doing rock comedy or rock kind of theatrics, I suppose. And then later on, when that folded, I was kind of doing bits and pieces of acting, and then an opportunity arose to start a comedy troupe. So again, it was not me on my own, it's me with two other people. So that was the kind of journey, I suppose, into comedy.
There's a film, isn't there? It's a bit like The Office, because I know you were a fan of The Office.
Yeah.
And it's about a rock group of that kind. And I know Ricky Gervais was actually influenced, isn't it? What was the name of that film?
Oh my God, what's it called? Oh, lads.
This is Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap.
Yeah, this is Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
I actually feel, this is a weird thing to say, but I feel like I have got a bit in common with Ricky Gervais. Like, he was like, you know, a big influence of mine. He was in a band. He studied philosophy in college. And he was like kind of, you know, doing his own thing, and then kind of fell into this big, massive comedy opportunity. So I always felt I'd get to a certain age, probably 40, and then these massive comedy opportunities would happen for me. Hasn't happened yet, John. Not down south anyway. I'd probably get more work like in the Middle East. But anyway, that's another story.
Well, now, speaking about the Middle East and more closer to home, politics closer to home, a lot of your comedy revolves around politics. And I read somewhere that you were influenced, maybe slightly, in your politics by the Late Late Show one night. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I think it was possibly 1994, I think it was. So I was a kid. At that stage, it would have been probably 10 or 11. And just I was watching it live, I suppose, like most of Ireland watched Late Late Show at the time. And forgive me, I don't have all the members of the panel, but it was Gerry Adams was giving an interview, and it was a thing. We were watching it because Gerry Adams is going to be on. And it was a fairly apolitical house that I grew up in. You know, people probably were sympathetic to the Republican struggle, but not in any demonstrative way, really. And certainly from the media that we consumed, we kind of were to believe that Gerry Adams almost personified all the problems with the North, that almost like, you know, every aspect of the conflict was on his shoulders, and that he bore personal responsibility for everything that had happened. I think it was the same night that Gay Byrne refused to shake his hand, and he basically sat down, and I didn't know that much about him before then, and I didn't know that much about the North either. And I think that's the key point, that, you know, when I watched that interview, I think Austin Curry was part of the panel, there was basically a lineup of people trying to take pops at him and traduce him in a variety of ways, and to pin, as I say, the whole conflict on his shoulders. And I just witnessed somebody really calmly, without any emotion whatsoever, refute every accusation that was coming to him, but more importantly, contextualised the conflict for the first time. I'd never heard that before. I hadn't heard anything about loyalist paramilitaries before. I just thought there was one. And I wasn't quite sure who they were fighting as a kid, but I just knew the IRA were fighting Britain, and that the impression I got from the mainstream media down south was that, you know, Ireland had won its independence, a few counties didn't make the grade, unfortunately, and they were kicking up all this storm and violence and murder because they were prone to murderousness. And we wish that they would just stop it, because they're really embarrassing us now on a kind of an international level. Now, I'm being a little bit playful when I say that, but that is roughly the sense of the North I had as a kid. So I wouldn't even say that I became like an Irish Republican watching that interview from Gerry Adams. I just became somebody that was really interested in the North. And that was the main thing for me. And because nobody had ever contextualised the conflict before, and more importantly, nobody had ever stated the important role that the South had played or not played, as whichever way you'd look at it, in creating the causes and conditions. And nobody had ever kind of detailed that before. For me, up until that moment, it was a kind of a separate thing. It was happening in a different place. It was unconnected to us. And as I say, we wish that they would just stop it. So definitely my head blew off my shoulders. I was like, okay, there's more to this than the mainstream media in the South is portraying. There's much more to this story than RTE and The Independent and The Irish Times are telling us. Because even, I mean, as a young kid, I was just interested in the news and, you know, I'd read bits and pieces of the newspaper and stuff. But so, yeah, that there was another alternative version of this history out there was new to me.
And did that galvanize you to explore things further, just politically? I mean, did you read up more on what was happening in the North? Or?
Yeah, I mean, within a few years, I suppose, I would have been a Sinn Féin supporter, I suppose, in school. And that would have been unusual, I think, in the South in that period as well. I remember there was two lads in my in my class in secondary school, and we were both kind of interested in Sinn Féin. And we went to a Sinn Féin youth meeting. And one of the lads, Ken is his name, he had... He had a copy of On Phoblacht, and I was reading On Phoblacht on my lunch break, and one of my teachers took me outside the door to ask me, was everything all right at home? and I think, you know, nothing that I've come across since encapsulates the complete misunderstanding of everything in the North that was going on down South at the time. And, you know, some people were doing it maliciously, you know, some people had agendas, but most people were just eating up the propaganda. And you see it today in the conflict that's going on right now in Gaza. Most people are just ordinary people going about their business. It's the people who are actually perpetrating and putting the propaganda out there. They have a responsibility. But your average person will become influenced by the propaganda that they consume. So I think most people down South just had this idea that there was just one perpetrator of violence in the North, and that Gerry Adams is a representative for them. And so he needed to be neutralised and censored, you know, and that's, I suppose, what was happening, literally.
You've mentioned Gaza there, and we'll get to that in a second. I just want to probe you more about your involvement with Irish reunification. And when I say involvement, you've been a strong advocate for reunification. Why is it important to you?
I think it's important to me because it connects directly to what I was saying earlier of growing up in a state that felt like it was completely disconnected from this other state. As soon as I started reading, I realised that that's not the case at all, and that there's a community of people in the North that don't feel disconnected. They feel the opposite. They feel like, you know, not that they feel Irish, they are Irish, and they think of themselves as part of the island of Ireland, and it would be their wish that that would be a 32-county republic. I think as you move towards breaking that sense of separation between the two, and you can do it physically. So, you know, I'm one of the few people I know in the South that goes to the North regularly, you know, and I'm not saying that in any kind of a flex. It's an embarrassing thing to say. The comedians on the scene, like Mario Rosenstock would be a good friend of mine. I think he's amazing. And he was telling me that I think he went to Belfast for the first time a couple of years ago, and that would be typical. The man's been touring for 20 years and he was wondering would people kind of know his stuff, whatever. And like the gig was sold out. I think he either did Ulster Hall or somewhere massive anyway. And everyone knew his stuff. Everyone had been following his stuff. And it's just typical of that sense of that kind of like spiritual, emotional, practical disconnect. I have, be it in my work, in my social life and, you know, making friends up here and stuff, that disconnect has never really been there for me. And if the disconnect isn't there, it makes no sense that they're two different states. Also, the history of Irish republicanism, I mean, if you're an Irish republican and you're an anti-imperialist, it would feel that it's the fitting thing for the destiny of the country would be to be reunited. And I would definitely make no apologies for that. It can sometimes be a slightly controversial thing to say or a slightly uncomfortable thing to say down south. And what I'm trying to do a little bit with my work is to get to the root of why anyone should be made to feel that that's uncomfortable. And I think, you know, something that we've spoken about a bit off camera, young people are amazing because young people are challenging that southern perspective all the time, that it's two separate states and two separate mentalities. So they're just some of the reasons why, I suppose, as an Irish Republican, shocker, I would want to see United Ireland.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our special guest, comedian and author, Tadhg Hickey. Moving on to events in Gaza that we've been all horrified by this last few months. You've been a very strong advocate for Palestinian self-determination. Has that been? And we spoke earlier, you'd said you'd met many new friends, friends in the Middle East and stuff like that. Tell us a bit about that.
I think with Palestine, and it's a little bit like with United Ireland as well, it comes back to something we touched on at the start of, like, in my drinking, I was inauthentic. You have to be inauthentic to kind of survive. You have to lie. You have to cheat. You have to let people down in order to keep doing it. And when I got sober, one thing I was very clear about for myself was to actually protect myself, to stop myself from falling into possibility of drinking again and taking drugs again, which I know will ultimately lead, if I relapse, I've no doubt that I'll die, and I don't want to die. So it's very basic with me. I have to be authentic. So if I have personal views about the conflict, and if I have personal views about my perspective on wanting a united Ireland, needless to say, a united Ireland that would be inclusive of everyone, not a narrow nationalism, I have no interest in that. If I have those views, I need to reflect those views in my work in order to be authentic. That's the way I would look at it, you know, and I hope that doesn't sound too kind of, I don't know, lavish or pretentious or whatnot, but that's the way I do think. So for instance, if I would lose some work opportunities down south for being authentic in my views, that's absolutely fine collateral damage. I need to be authentic. So in the case of Palestine, I have always felt that it's actually one of the most, bizarrely, it's one of the most easy conflicts to understand, which is in direct opposition to the key Israeli claim that it's too complex for you and I to ever understand. It's just a case, it's a land grab, it's settler colonialism. And I think if I'm going to be authentic about Ireland, I need to also be authentic about Palestine and not worry too much about the backlash that you will get. Also, I have friends that are doing comedy in the States and Canada and places like that. They have backlash, like they have serious, I mean, you know, they have serious repercussions to worry about. In Ireland, it's less so. So I feel like, you know, many Arab friends have sent me messages. I mean, if you saw my messages on Instagram, like it's hard not to be crying at times, because there's people saying, you know, it's refreshing to hear someone from the West just highlight what's going on here. Like, so it's basically like Ireland on a kind of a global level for me. It's like, you know, people hating you because they don't want to have the conversation, and then people loving you because they see it's unusual for a white face to be fronting something that's talking about the decades of oppression, murder, mayhem, second-class citizenship, you name it, apartheid that they're living under. So, again, if you're going to be authentic, you accept that you're going to get some people, you know, I had a Zionist witch saying that she was putting a curse on me and all that kind of stuff. But then I had loads of Muslim friends saying that they'd undone the curse. So that was a bit of crack, like, you know. But as regards work and stuff, I made a kind of a pact with myself a long time ago that I was going to be real. To me, anyway, I'm not saying it's the reality. It's my reality. It's my belief system. And if that means that I don't get work with the BBC or RT, then so be it.
I think you're being too kind to yourself when you say, you know, you don't get it hard here as an artist when you stray off the conventions. I mean, like, we as a country steeped in censorship, I think still if you stray off those conventions that you do get it hard. And you see that particularly from establishment journalists, establishment politicians. And I think you've been the receiving end of that also.
Yeah, I suppose with journalists, they'll have jobs. Like, I don't, like, because I'm working for myself, I'm lucky. You know what I mean? Like, they'll attempt to, you know, so there's people online who've tried to get my gigs cancelled and whatnot.
Welcome to the club.
Huh?
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. I suppose that's, you know, to be honest with you, that can be tough at times because, you know, when that campaign was going online by this, I say campaign as being kind to the guy, like, it seemed to just be one guy. But like, I also have a new baby, you know, and I have a partner and I have kids, like, I've got two kids. So, like, it's easy for me to be like, you know, it's like the song, you know, my love ain't got no money, but he's got a strong beliefs. It's grand for me to say that, but I need to be able to provide for my family as well. So it can be scary at times to think that, oh, OK, what happens here if I actually get completely cancelled? But I don't know, maybe I'm just a bit of a dreamer that way, but I just kind of think if you just plow on. And also, I feel like with the stuff I'm doing, I'm not being nasty either, really. You know what I mean? I'm not kind of like, I'm not doing a Dave Chappelle on it. Don't get me wrong. Dave Chappelle is a comedy god to people like me. You know, his early stuff is the Chappelle Show is some of the best satire I've ever seen in my life. And that's what makes it so sad that he went from punching up so elegantly to now just lazily punching down. But I feel myself, and I'm always checking in with people that I respect to see, am I doing the right job with it? You know, before I write a sketch about Palestine, for instance, I've got about two or three Palestinian friends that I run it by just to make sure that the detail is there and stuff, because I don't want to become lazy or assume that that they want this white lad from Cork to speak for them. Like, you know, even at the start of when October 7th happened and then the absolutely insane response that we've seen since, some people said, oh, you should do a sketch on this or you should do a sketch on that. I asked Palestinians because I was like, this mightn't be the moment for comedy. You know, I don't want to come in on something like, it's hard to even think of what, and you'll be able to tell me better, what the Irish parallel for this is. You know, what Palestinians are going through right now. I mean, it feels like it's Nakba point one or whatever, like, you know. So was comedy even an appropriate thing to do? And time again, they'd come back. And that's, I think, why Irish and Palestinians get on so well. They've got this jet black sense of humour. My Palestinian friends in Cork were like, man, we need you, like, get in there. Like, and also, a good buddy of mine in Cork was kind of saying, you'll never have an opportunity like this again because the other side is making such a show of itself with its so-called propaganda that you've got to get in there, like, or it's a missed opportunity if you don't, you know. So, yeah.
So tell us what's happening this year. What are we going to see next from Tadhg Hygge?
Well, I've been lucky enough to build up a nice little following from the Arab world. Like on Instagram, I have, just if you're interested, I have much more followers in Turkey and Jordan than I would in Ireland. Unreal. Way more, like, yeah. Doesn't surprise me. me at all, by the way. So I'd like, I mean, in an ideal world, if I was going to do a tour again, I'd love to tour over there. I'd love to tour in places where it's news to me that someone from the West having a kind of an anti-imperialist perspective and somebody shining a light on the hypocrisy and atrocities of the American Empire, that would be a refreshing thing to see from their perspective. But it is. So I'd like to eventually go over there and tour there. And also, for a while now, I've been trying to turn a sketch I did a couple of years ago that caused a lot of controversy. You may have seen it, about a loyalist and a house share in Cork with the, you know, England, Scotland, Ireland and all that. I've been trying to turn that with another writer in Ireland, Michael West is his name, brilliant writer, playwright, into a full kind of TV show stroke film kind of effort. So, but it would go above, I mean, they're just standing for the actual, you know, there's no depth to any of those characters. Like, it's just, you know, Scotland is just a crazy wig and a kind of a Scotland jersey. But we've built them up into full dimensional characters. I hope it could be a TV show. And I'm talking to people of significance who are interested in it, shall we say. So I would love to see some sort of Brexit, but it's a house share in Cork, develop into a TV show or a film.
Tadhg, looking forward to that. And it's always good to see you in Belfast. I'd say it'd be safe to consider your second home now.
Oh, man. Well, definitely West Belfast, anyway.
Well, listen, thank you for coming. Always good to see you.
Pleasure, brother.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Tadhg Hygge. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Judge Scott McAfee is allowing Donald Trump and his election interference co-defendants to appeal an order denying the disqualification of Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis from the case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us.